This is the Breaker.News podcast for June 17th, 2018. Welcome. I'm Bob Mackin, publisher of the Breaker.News and host of the Breaker.News podcast. The Breaker is your source for news, opinion, and analysis about British Columbia issues, institutions, and influencers. Later, I'll tell you how you can support the Breaker. On this edition, regular features such as the Is It Just Me commentary, Around the Rim, headlines about the Pacific Rim, Cascadia Calling, headlines about the Pacific Northwest, The Big Deal feature, another round of grilling for Aggregate IQ, a House of Commons committee presses for answers on the Facebook Cambridge Analytica scandal, and I'll award a virtual Nanaimo bar to someone or a group of people who made a difference. Now, is it just me? Is it just me, or do we now have more evidence that the government of British Columbia and Chicago and Minneapolis and Glendale, Arizona and Alberta were all right to stand up to FIFA and its greedy demands? North America, as predicted, will host the biggest World Cup in history in 2026 with 48 nations. The United States gets 60 games and Canada and Mexico get 10 each. Morocco, the only other bidder, had no chance. FIFA evaluators said that its plans for stadiums, hotels, and transportation were all high risk. Documents released by the BC government to The Breaker just days before the vote in Moscow showed that the CEO of the BC Pavilion Corporation had serious reservations, six to be exact. The theme of Ken Cretney's letter on March 9th to the bid committee was that BC Place needed more clarity, more information, and more negotiation before it could sign on the dotted line. And it turned out that it was the United Bid Committee that turned down Vancouver, not the BC NDP government turning down FIFA. Canada Soccer's Peter Montopoli issued an ultimatum back on March 13th, sign the contract as is within 12 hours or FIFA will move on. Guess what? FIFA moved on. So, no blank check from BC taxpayers to FIFA, which is only 3 years removed from a massive corruption and bribery scandal that is still not resolved. Canadians do love the beautiful game, but they can't stand the ugly politics lurking behind the scenes of the Swiss soccer aristocracy. Transparency International ran a poll last year and found 53% of fans around the world had no confidence in FIFA, and only a quarter thought that Sepp Blatter's successor, Gianni Infantino, had restored any trust in FIFA. So, good luck to Toronto and Montreal and Edmonton, and Seattle too, and good luck to coach John Herdman and his Canadian team. You've got 8 years to prepare. The world is coming. What do you think? Email Bob at thebreaker.news. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Around the Rim. We look at news headlines about the Pacific Rim. In the Straits Times, Ing King Jean reports Trump-Kim summit, nearly 4 million tweets posted worldwide from June 1st to 13th. Nearly 4 million tweets were posted on the historic Trump-Kim summit from June 1st to 13th, the day the meeting was confirmed, to the day after the event, Twitter said in a statement on June 14th. In comparison, the most tweeted about global event last year was the Miss Universe pageant, which saw about 34 million related tweets during the event. From June 10th to 12th, after both leaders touched down in Singapore until the end of the summit, the Straits Times official Twitter account received nearly 13,000 retweets and more than 16,000 likes on its 256 tweets, according to data from social media analytics firm LocoWise. In the South China Morning Post, Ian Young reports, Canadian hospital sues mother of million-dollar baby amid growing concern over Chinese birth tourism. Yan Cha spent months in Richmond Hospital with her baby in spring 2012. There was a massive hospital bill because of the complicated pregnancy. With interest, this would stand at almost $1.2 million. Their current whereabouts are unknown, although China would be an excellent guess. Yan's case is revealed in a lawsuit by Vancouver Coastal Health that was filed on April 12th in pursuit of the unpaid bill. According to a spokesperson of Vancouver Coastal Health, the overwhelming majority of non-resident mothers who give birth in Richmond Hospital list China as their place of residence. And in the Honolulu Star Advertiser, Lee Cataluna reports, Big Isle Tourism Campaign Gets Love in Ohio. The Hawaii Island Visitors Bureau, the Hawaii Island Chamber of Commerce, and Kona Kohala Chamber of Commerce have launched a social media campaign to convince would-be travelers to come to Hawaii despite everything they've seen and heard about the volcano. Businesses on Hawaii Island are being encouraged to post photos and videos showing the beauty of the island and to include the hashtags Explore Island of Hawaii and Visit Island of Hawaii. Hawaii Island is open for business, and there's lots to do without getting near the frightening lava or getting in the way of residents trying to cope with the eruption. Meanwhile, Drew and Cindy Abbas, a married couple from Ohio, spontaneously became part of the effort. They were interviewed by their local TV news about their recent trip to Hawaii. The family spent a week on Hawaii Island in May, and Drew and Cindy calmly told the folks at home in Cincinnati that their trip was great. That's Around the Rim on this edition of the Breaker.News podcast. Now it's time on the Breaker.News podcast for Cascadia Calling. We look at news headlines around the Pacific Northwest. In the Seattle Times, Gene Balk reports, "Suicide rate up across Washington, but why? No one is exactly sure," expert says. From 2014 to 2016, Washington's suicide rate was 15.1 deaths per 100,000 people. That represents a 19% increase from the rate in the period from 1999 to 2001. There are now more than 1,100 suicide deaths a year in the state, making it the eighth leading cause of death. And for Washingtonians between the ages of 15 and 34, it ranks as the number two cause after accidental injuries. White middle-aged men aged 45 to 54 are a particularly high-risk demographic, representing one out of eight suicides in Washington. Other groups known to have alarmingly high suicide rates nationally are veterans and transgender people. In the Oregonian, Elliot Injuice reports, ESCO site in northwest Portland, eyed for MLB Stadium, sold to Portland developers. A large northwest Portland industrial site eyed for a potential Major League Baseball stadium has been sold to a group of longtime real estate investors and developers. The buyers outbid the group, angling to bring a baseball team to the city, but the sale doesn't totally preclude the possibility of building a ballpark on the site, one of the buyers said. The seller is ESCO Corp., a maker of mining and construction equipment that was founded more than a century ago in Portland. The $33 million deal for 22 acres closed Friday. It was first reported by the Portland Business Journal. A baseball stadium has been floated by the Portland Diamond Project, a group of local investors that was joined this month by Seattle Seahawks quarterback Russell Wilson and singer Ciara. In the Times Colonist, Jack Knox reports, "Stephen Reed, from bank robber to author and back again." Stephen Reed, 68, died in hospital Tuesday in Haida Gwaii, where he shared a home with his wife, Susan Musgrave, also a well-known writer and sometime resident of the Sanet Peninsula. He had been seriously ill with a heart ailment. Reed was a polarizing figure. Some saw only a criminal, others a man far more complex than his headlines. He emerged from a troubled youth to become a member of the notorious Stopwatch Gang, which, in the 1970s, pulled off more than 100 slickly orchestrated bank robberies in Canada and the U.S. That streak ended with Reed's arrest in 1980. It was in prison that he turned to writing. He met Musgrave, then writer-in-residence at the University of Waterloo, after sending her a manuscript. They got married in Kent Institution in Agassiz in 1986. He wrote fiction and poetry and taught writing. He was charming, and the literati loved him. Underneath his seemingly happy life was Reed's struggle with addiction. In Masset, Mayor Andrew Merrilees found Reed a very personable and charming man. At the same time, it was hard to forget what he had done. And these were some of the stories we followed this week in the Breaker.News. NDP government downplays BC visit from high-ranking Chinese Communist Party apparatchiks. Politburo member Wang Chan led a 24-person entourage to Vancouver on June 10th for a private dinner with the Lieutenant Governor and members of John Horgan's cabinet. BC's gambling regulator suggests that ads for shady poker and sports gambling sites should be pulled. The Gaming Policy and Enforcement Branch is preparing a complaint to the Advertising Standards Council over ads by unlicensed online gambling companies. And an update. Prosecutors will appeal the acquittal of Ken Chung, the speeding Audi driver who slammed into a car driven by Dr. Alphonsus Hui in 2015. Hui died at the scene. Judge Gregory Rideout found Chung not guilty on May 25th, despite Chung speeding at nearly three times the speed limit. Read those stories and more in the Breaker.news. Now it's time for the big deal feature on the Breaker.news podcast. Information and privacy investigators on both sides of the Atlantic are working hard to get to the bottom of the Facebook Cambridge Analytica data mining scandal, and how a Victoria, BC company's work influenced elections in both the UK and the US. On June 12th, Aggregate IQ co-founder Jeff Sylvester made his second appearance in Ottawa before the House of Commons Committee on Access to Information, Privacy, and Ethics about the scandal. He had appeared with CEO Zach Massingham on April 24th. They were both called back to the committee after whistleblower Christopher Wiley's May 29th testimony. This time, however, Massingham did not appear. Sylvester claimed that he was ill. Timmins James Bay NDP member Charlie Angus challenged Sylvester on Wiley's testimony that Sylvester had boasted that what Aggregate IQ was doing was illegal.
So did Mr. Wiley lie to our committee because he was under oath?
No, because the statements that he said at the time with respect to not receiving a text from me.
What you said was a complete lie, that you knew that what you were doing was illegal. Did he lie to our committee?
No, I believe he's mistaken. It's not a question of lying or not lying. I think largely
what
we
see... Well, largely what we see... someone says that what you were doing is completely illegal, that's a complete attack on your professional career, and he said you laughed. So that couldn't be a misinterpretation. That's either true or it's false. He either lied, or I'd suggest that you may be lying, but you can't just say it's a difference of opinion.
Well, this is
legal or illegal.
But this is a conversation that took place in 2017, in April of 2017. I don't recall ever telling him that I thought it was illegal. We did speak about the media and what they thought. Perhaps he interpreted what I was saying about the media as me saying it myself. I don't know, because I've not been able to communicate about them. But the best way to resolve this would be for him and I to talk about it. But unfortunately, that's not happening.
Because he says your claims are, quote, completely false. He said that under oath. It seems to me really strange that we have a listing of documents with your colleague as head of SCL Canada, your colleague who's not here with a phone number for SCL Canada. He says AIQ was set up because there were projects that were run by SCL and then Cambridge Analytica that needed a team of engineers to perform the work. And you were set up to do that work as a, what he said, as a franchise operation of SCL. He said that to us under oath. Is that true?
We were never set up as a franchise. We certainly did work for SCL.
Pierre Fondelar, Liberal Frank Bayliss grilled Sylvester on whether or not Aggregate IQ was cooperating with the United Kingdom Information Commissioner's investigation.
When I asked you why there's a disconnect, did it not dawn on you when you wrote this that you did not answer any of her questions, and that's why she wants to take legal action against you?
Yeah, so when, after our meeting...
When I asked you it last time you were here, and you obfuscated, and quite frankly, Mr. Sylvester, you lied to me. Now you're here again, and you're under oath. This is what was written in the letter. Is it not clear to you that you did not answer her letter, you did not answer her questions, and you told her by saying unilaterally that it's closed, that you were not going to answer her questions?
So I didn't lie to you before, and with respect to when you brought up that issue, I did wonder how she came to that conclusion. That's why we reached out afterwards to have a conversation directly with her. And we heard back from them as to why they thought.
You wondered how she got to the conclusion when you said, I'm not going to answer your question. When you said our involvement in your investigation is closed and we're not subject to your jurisdiction, you wondered how she came to that conclusion. You just said that.
Yeah.
I want to make sure. You wondered how she got to that conclusion.
Yeah, because I never said I wouldn't answer
questions. Okay, let me explain something to you. If I asked you a question and you told me I'm not subject to your jurisdiction and the investigation is closed, you would wonder how I came to the conclusion that you're not cooperating?
I didn't believe their investigation was closed.
I asked you a question. You would wonder how I came to the conclusion that you're not cooperating.
I would wonder how you would think, how you would state that we said that we wouldn't answer any questions.
I asked you a straight question. If you gave me this answer,
correct.
I asked you a question, you say, Frank, we're not subject to the jurisdiction of your office, and we consider our involvement in your office's investigation closed, and you would wonder why I would think you're not cooperating, and not, excuse me, entirely cooperative.
Well, they may not have liked all of the answers.
There were no answers. You just told them you're not cooperating.
No, well, they may...
Let me be clear. You would wonder, if I got that, why I would think you're not cooperating.
No, I would wonder why you would say that we refuse to answer questions.
Montarville Liberal member Michelle Picard asked Sylvester about some of the techniques that his company uses, including spoofing phone numbers for phone bank operators to use.
So, Mr. Sylvester, I just want to pick up on my colleague's point. So you have admitted that you have created spoofing call ID numbers?
Yeah, we created a tool with a program called Twilio, and it allows you to register an address or a phone number for a campaign, for example, or for a central office where people, when they call from, that's what shows up. All of those people had to be registered with the campaign in order to do that.
So who are the clients you created for?
The phone from home program is being used in the in an American campaign in the U.S.
I'm sorry?
It's in an American campaign for Senate in the U.S.
And what's the name of the program?
The program? Oh, the program itself.
No, you just said something before that. I didn't hear you.
Yeah, the program, that particular thing is a mobile app, and it's being used by one of our clients to provide in turn to another client, but both in the U.S.
Now, I also understand that recently Facebook has suspended a number of apps of yours after apparently they banned you from the platform. So do you have any other apps that are running under the AIQ name on Facebook?
And no.
So you have no apps?
Not to my knowledge.
None that you've developed for any other client? Nothing?
I don't think so, no.
So none of that, okay.
I mean, if we made something a long time ago and it happens to be running, but we're not using it, I don't know. But any of the things that we've been actively working with in any way have been stopped.
So there's nothing that, to your knowledge?
Not to my knowledge, no.
Okay.
Ottawa West Nepean Liberal member Anita Vandenbeld asked Sylvester about Aggregate IQ's work to develop a cryptocurrency token.
First of all, one of the items in the documents that were found, the repository, was a cryptocurrency called a Midas token. So who did the minimum buy-in for this cryptocurrency was $10,000. Who was this done for?
We have a client in that came to us in British Columbia, who wanted to create a token. We did the work for them, and they haven't launched it yet, though. So.
Okay, and what would they do with this kind of token? Like, where is the value?
The idea essentially is that they were trying to raise money for a project they were doing, and people who contributed to the token, once the project gets up and going, they then receive the benefits of that project. But the company, or the organization, I should say, is working with their legal team in terms of meeting all of the British Columbia security regulations and all the federal security regulations. So we haven't launched that yet.
Okay. Have you ever been paid for any of your services in any cryptocurrency?
I mean, no. From a company, no. I bought some poutine for a friend and they paid me in cryptocurrency, but our company has not been paid in cryptocurrency.
Okay. Nathaniel Erskine-Smith, the Liberal vice chair from Beaches East York, threatened to fine Massingham in contempt for not appearing at the hearing. Massingham had sent a doctor's note claiming that he was ill.
First, I just want to impress upon you the disappointment of this committee in the failure of Mr. Massingham to attend, and I encourage you to impress upon your colleague the significance of this, and that we are going to go we're going to have a conversation as a committee about how to proceed, and we're going to discuss the potential of moving forward with a finding of contempt. So I'd encourage your colleague to attend before us and come forward with dates that he can make himself available.
We provided the information why he couldn't attend to your clerk. And
well, very limited information, and look, I got a lot of friends who are lawyers, and
that's fine. As that process unfolds, we're happy to participate.
You've clearly lawyered up, and frankly, the information you provided is inadequate.
There's much more to come on the political data mining issue. We'll keep you updated on thebreaker.news. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or group of people that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to all of those people who stepped forward to help the residents of Mountain Village in North Vancouver at a time of great need. A devastating fire at the apartment complex on June 11th killed Nargis Khaznajad and her son Sapir Dalshad. 15 other people were treated in hospital. This virtual Nanaimo bar is for you, the first responders, Lynn Valley residents, Lions Club members, landlords with vacant units who are helping the residents get back on their feet. Thank you. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. Every week, we end the Breaker.News podcast on a tasty note by awarding the goodness of a virtual Nanaimo bar to a deserving person or group of people that has made a difference. A virtual version of the province's favorite dessert bar goes this week to all of those people who stepped forward to help the residents of Mountain Village in North Vancouver at a time of great need. A devastating fire at the apartment complex on June 11th killed Nargis Khaznajad and her son Sapir Dalshad. 15 other people were treated in hospital. This virtual Nanaimo bar is for you, the first responders, Lynn Valley residents, Lions Club members, landlords with vacant units who are helping the residents get back on their feet. Thank you. You can nominate someone for a virtual Nanaimo bar. Send us an email to bob@thebreaker.news. That's it for the Breaker.News podcast for June 17th, 2018. I'm Bob Mackin. Thanks for joining me. Did you know that on June 17th, 1972, five men were arrested for breaking into the Democratic Party's office at the Watergate complex in Washington, D.C.? More than 2 years later, President Richard Nixon resigned. The five men were Virgilio Gonzalez, Bernard Barker, James McCord, Eugenio Martinez, and Frank Sturgis. Well, now you know. Send me your feedback, send me your story ideas to bob@thebreaker.news. Bookmark thebreaker.news. You can also find us at thebreaker.ca. Sign up for the email newsletter and get updates to your inbox. For news as it happens, follow The Breaker News on Twitter and visit thebreaker.news on Facebook. You can support The Breaker for as little as $2 a month. For more information, go to patreon.com/thebreakernews. That's patreon.com/thebreakernews. Until next week.